thing that really jumps out is just how poor the trade craft is.
So what's being done after an incursion into the U.S. president's resort in Florida while he was there? This is Thursday, the 4th of April, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melbourne in Washington. Remember to join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, a White House official tells reporters that the U.S. and China made good headway in Beijing last week. The United Nations gets involved in the criticism of new Sharia law elements in Brunei. A Chinese woman was arrested after entering U.S. President Donald Trump's Florida retreat, carrying a device containing malicious computer software last week. According to court documents filed by federal prosecutors Monday, Yu Jingzhang approached a Secret Service agent at President Trump's Mar-a-Lago retreat in Palm Beach seeking entrance to the private club, claiming she was a member and wanted to go to the pool. Although agents could not initially find her name on the membership list, she was eventually allowed inside after a club manager thought she was the daughter of a member. But once she was admitted into the club, Zhang told a receptionist she was there to attend an event by a group called the United Nations Chinese American Association. When the staff found no such event on the schedule, Secret Service agents were notified and Zhang was detained. A search of her possessions discovered four cell phones, a laptop computer, an external hard drive, and a small data storage device known as a thumb drive that contained the malicious software. Zhang has been charged with making false statements to federal agents and illegally entering a restricted area. A statement by the Secret Service says it does not determine who is invited or welcome at Mar-a-Lago, saying it is the responsibility of the host entity. Joining us on VOA Asia is Peter Harrell of the Center for a New American Security, where his focus is on the intersection of economics and national security. We spoke via Skype. Please pardon some technical difficulties.
I think there's been discussion over the last 2 years or more now about the security risks posed by all the time President Trump spends at Mar-a-Lago. He's certainly entitled to spend as much time as he wants at Mar-a-Lago, but clearly you have a large facility with thousands of people a year coming in and out, and it's a place where the President of the United States conducts a lot of official business, and that makes it inherently a very attractive target for espionage. I think this case, kind of bizarre and surreal as the facts of this case are, bring home the fact that, you know, Mar-a-Lago and the president's other properties are indeed very attractive espionage targets for foreign governments. This isn't just a hypothetical concern. It's a real concern. And I think that we're going to see the Secret Service probably tighten up the facilities, in the coming weeks and months. On this particular case, one thing that really jumps out is just how poor the trade craft is. I mean, if the Chinese government has an incredibly effective, sophisticated intelligence service, and if the Chinese government at the senior-most levels really wanted to get somebody in to Mar-a-Lago to plant malware, I think they would have run a lower-profile, better-organized operation than this.
So I take it you do not believe this might be a high-level Chinese operation?
Yeah, so I think, you know, when you look at Chinese espionage, you see a couple of kinds of espionage. You definitely see, you know, high level, top down, centrally planned, very sophisticated operations. You look at some of the cyber attacks that have been mounted against, U.S. Defense contractors, against the U.S. government itself. Those are clearly very sophisticated operations. But I think you also see a number of cases that are maybe what you might call more of bottom-up espionage, where, you know, a mid-level official or maybe somebody who isn't directly connected to the Chinese government but maybe is trying to ingratiate themselves to the Chinese government kind of takes it on their own to see if they can get access to some confidential information. And then if they get that information, go ahead and pass it back up the chain. And I think that that can be attractive to the Chinese government because it gives the Chinese government a degree of plausible deniability. You know, if one of these operations goes badly, like this one clearly did, you know, the central government probably has plausible deniability there. On the other hand, if they, you know, get something out of it, if the operation's successful, you know, the Chinese government gets the information that is useful to it. So this strikes me, I wouldn't rule out this being a, you know, top-down operation that went horribly wrong, but that seems less likely to me than that this was some kind of, you know, bottom-up or, you know, freelancing operation by, you know, either somebody trying to ingratiate themselves to the Chinese government or, you know, maybe with participation of a, you know, low-level or mid-level official. But I think on balance, if this was a really sort of top-down operation decided at the highest levels of the Chinese government, it wouldn't have come off as quite as much amateur hour as this thing is coming off.
Peter Harrell is a senior fellow at the Center for New American Security. Peter, thank you so much. This is VOA Asia. White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow said Wednesday that U.S. trade talks with China are continuing to progress as negotiations between the world's two biggest economies resume in Washington this week. Kudlow told reporters that the two countries made good headway in Beijing last week, with China acknowledging such problematic issues as the theft of intellectual property, forced technology transfers, and computer hacking. He said no decisions have been made on automobile tariffs. U.S. lawmakers are taking a wait-and-see attitude on the lengthy talks. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, a key ally of President Trump, told VOA's Mandarin service that he was hopeful.
I think the president is right to insist on change. We want it to be a win-win for both countries. And we'll see. We'll know in a few weeks here.
The VO Mandarin service also spoke with another Republican, Senator Tom Tillis.
One of the things that I'm particularly focused on is intellectual property and intellectual property protection. So I hope that we're moving along not only the general terms of trade agreement, but also a real focus on what I think is the single greatest threat long term, and that's having China more productively participate in the protection of intellectual property.
Republican Senator Charles Grassley said the U.S. hopes to complete the trade negotiations by the end of April, but Myron Brilliant, executive vice president at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, a lobby for the biggest American corporations, said concluding the talks will not be easy, saying you're talking about a set of issues that require some changes, significant changes, in China's behavior. Newly elected Islamic laws governing gay sex and adultery in the nation of Brunei have sparked international outcry. The laws, which took effect today, will allow those convicted of adultery and homosexuality to be stoned to death. These harsh penalties have been included in the Southeast Asian country's Sharia Penal Code, which was instituted in 2014. The new laws apply to children and foreigners, even if they're not Muslim. Under the laws, thieves could have their right hand amputated on their first offense and their left foot on their second. The codes are designed to bolster the influence of Islam in the Muslim-majority country of about 430,000 people. Celebrities like Elton John, Ellen DeGeneres, and George Clooney have denounced the new laws. They've helped rally support for a boycott of 9 hotels in the United States and Europe with ties to the leader of Brunei. U.S. Secretary of State Deputy Spokesman Robert Paladino said Brunei's decision runs counter to its international human rights obligations and that the U.S. strongly opposes violence, criminalization, and discrimination against vulnerable groups. Joining us is VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir. And Margaret, we understand the United Nations is at least attempting to take some action on this.
Right, Ira. Well, the UN in principle stands against the death penalty in any situation, except there's one international principle that really reserves the death penalty for only the most serious crimes, and that would be intentional killing or murder. So the Secretary General has made a statement through his spokesperson today saying that you know, all human rights are to be upheld, whether the person is gay or not, and that this legislation is in clear violation of traditional international human rights principles, and it goes against different conventions. For instance, you mentioned children can be subjected to this. So as I understand the law, anyone who has reached puberty in Brunei is considered as an adult. Young children could be whipped for certain offenses under this ruling. So this would violate, for instance, the Convention of Rights of the Child. It's also when they're stoning to death gays or adulterers, this could violate international prohibitions against torture and ill treatment. So the UN is very unhappy about it. The High Commissioner for Human Rights has also issued a very extensive statement about it, appealing to the government to stop the entry into force of what she called this new draconian penal law. So there is strong opposition to it here at the United Nations. And interestingly, Brunei has the death penalty on its books, but it was last used in 1957. So the country hasn't even used the death penalty in over 60 years.
What is it that the United Nations can do to do something about that beside expressing their disdain?
Well, there's really not too much the UN can do. You know, they can't tell individual countries how to operate. But there's certain pressure in naming and shaming, as we say around here. So, you know, if you get statements from the top levels of the UN, if other countries step up and start speaking about it, as you mentioned, the United States condemned it. Several members of the European Union have condemned it. Around the world, there are more than 160 countries that have either abolished the death penalty or have moratoriums on it. They don't practice it. So we may be, you know, hear more from those countries about this, because in the 21st century, it seems, you know, completely out of whack to be having laws against adultery and homosexuality when these have become accepted things in society.
Margaret Bashir is the VOA UN correspondent, joining us from New York. Margaret, as always, thank you.
Thanks, Ira.
We continue now. Solomon Islanders headed to the polls Wednesday, surrounded by tight security amid fears of electoral interference. The Melanesian archipelago was part of an arc of insecurity around northeastern Austria following ethnic violence, rampant crime, and failing government in the early 2000s. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
In 2003, Australia led a multinational peacekeeping effort that restored democracy to the Solomon Islands. The mission officially ended in 2017, and Australia has sent troops to monitor Wednesday's poll. In a land of rugged mountains and active volcanoes, the Solomon Islands election is a huge logistical challenge. Australian military helicopters have delivered ballot papers to remote parts of the South Pacific archipelago. There are concerns over alleged vote buying on so-called Devil's Night that falls the day before the election. Anti-corruption group Transparency Solomon Islands said that vote buying had now become a common aspect of elections in the Solomon Islands. Solomon Islands Police Commissioner Matthew Varley is urging voters to respect democracy.
People talk about Devil's Night. My question is, how much is your vote worth? How much is your voice worth? Because this is what a person's vote is. It's their right to choose the leaders of this nation. And if we're going to sell our vote for $200 or a bag of rice, then I think we can do better than that.
International diplomacy is also a feature of the election. The Solomon Islands is Taiwan's biggest ally in the South Pacific. But the caretaker Prime Minister Rick Ho has promised to review diplomatic ties with Taipei if re-elected, while downplaying fears it would mean a switch to China. There is, however, speculation that the Solomon Islands could affirm its diplomatic allegiance to China, which is a key trading partner, although such a move is denied by the archipelago's leading political parties. 15 parties are contesting the election. More than 330 candidates are competing for 50 seats in parliament. National issues such as healthcare and infrastructure will dominate the poll. This voter is supporting her local lawmaker.
In our constituency, he's helped. For example, lots of old people. People have engines. He's helped build main roads, trucks. He's the one who's helped people.
The Solomon Islands is an archipelago in the South Pacific Ocean that lies to the northeast of Australia. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful day and night ahead.